Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, summer jobs are plentiful, how to help young people prepare for interviewing and the expectations of the workplace. And we're in the thick of pollen season. We'll get the latest and talk about what's ahead with allergist Donald Devoren, a certified pollen counter. But to begin, as of this moment, the Tokyo Olympics are set to get underway in late July, even if the city and other areas in Japan remain under a state of emergency because of a surge in the pandemic there. This from John Coates, Vice President of the International Olympic Committee. However, Coates is getting pushback. The 6,000-member Tokyo Medical Practitioners Association is calling for the Olympics to be canceled, and public opinion in Japan is largely running against the Summer Games. Officials say the final deadline to call off the Games is a month away, and if the competition doesn't happen in 2021, the Tokyo Olympics will be canceled, not postponed for a second time. In the meantime, elite athletes continue to train under a cloud of uncertainty, so we thought it would be a good time to check in once again with Olympic swimmer Kelsey Worldalia. A gold medal winner, she helped the USA team to gold in Rio in the 4x100 meters medley, and her swim career began in Burlington County, New Jersey. Kelsey, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So when we last spoke, it was in March of last year, right after we learned the 2020 Games had been postponed. And here it is a year later, you and your fellow athletes are training hard once again and are now facing the possibility of perhaps a cancellation if things get even worse with the virus in Japan. So what are your thoughts about training and all the uncertainty around Tokyo?
As of right now, we are going if there's a green light. We hear everything from the USOPC and our individual sport delegation. So USA Swimming is going on as planned. We have our Olympic trials to select our Olympic team in 20 days. So we are in the thick of training and getting ready to be at the best shape of our lives. So we're hoping that everything goes as planned.
So you're kind of keeping the news headlines on the back burner. You're just focusing on what the IOC is saying right now.
Yeah, we've been told just to listen to them and to try to keep the rumors at bay and not listen so much to them. So I've deleted my Twitter and just trying to listen to the credible sources.
So give us a sense, Kelsey, of what training ahead of the swim trials involves right now. Well, how are your days structured?
So this is the best time of the year. We start to taper as we get close to our biggest competitions. So that means sharpening everything up and lifting a little more explosively and eventually cutting out lifting. So right now my practices have shortened to an hour and a half instead of 2 hours and just starting to feel really light and strong and fast in the water. So I'm really loving it.
So let's talk about training in 2021 as opposed to, right around when we last talked to you, right after the pandemic caused everything to crash early in 2020. Remind us of what you put together at home to help you train.
Mm-hmm. I had to get really creative in terms of my training because pools stayed closed for a few months and gyms for even longer. So I rented some CrossFit equipment and built a gym in my garage with the help of my husband and eventually bought my own gym equipment. So I've been lifting in my garage for most of the year. And then for a few months, I was swimming in a 9x12-foot sized pool in my backyard with a filter and heating system, but I would swim in place. It was really boring, but it got the job done, and I was able to keep the feel of the water, which is hard to articulate, but you can't replicate swimming in any other way except just being in the water. So by swimming in place, I was at least able to keep the feel of the water, keep that muscle memory when I couldn't get in a normal size pool.
So you had to train an extra year to get to this point. Has it been challenging to keep training and et cetera at a high level for an extra 12 months?
It has, especially since competitions have been fewer. We love swimming. Most of us swimmers love to swim because we get to compete and we get to race. And so trying to replicate that in practices has been challenging, and just the mental emotional side of things has been really tough. I think last year I was kind of grateful to have a summer off without the kind of FOMO, like the fear of missing out, when I've been on the national team for the last 5 summers and there's a lot of pressure that comes with that. So to have a summer off of that and to allow my emotional side of things to come down, but now it's ramping up again. And so I'm grateful for the support staff we have and mental health people in my corner to remind me just what things are important to stay focused on.
So when the pressure is high, what are some steps that you take to just kind of relieve the pressure a little bit, even as you're in an intense period right now looking ahead to the Olympics?
Mm-hmm. My faith is really important to me, and so I remind myself of my purpose in my swimming, and I'm grateful that I have great support from my family and friends, and I know that I'm loved no matter the result, and so that gives me a lot of peace going forward or whatever the results at that trial. But otherwise, if I'm feeling really overwhelmed, I know I have psychologists or coaches who I can turn to who can kind of help me calm down and not feel so overwhelmed, and know that the pressure is something that I put on myself, not that is expected from me from anyone else.
I'm sure most Olympic athletes do the same. They put pressure on themselves because they want to be able to perform as well as possible. So you're not alone. And speaking of that too, how are your teammates faring in an unusual year? I mean, again, when you won gold in Rio, you were part of the 4x100 meters medley team. So you're working with other women. What are they saying about all this?
I'm really grateful for our USA Swimming family, I guess you could say, that I've gotten to know so well over the years. And we have been able to have Pro Swim Series stops the last few months where we've been able to race, and it's kind of like a catch up where we get to see how everyone's been doing. And I'm really proud of how everyone's been training through the pandemic. And in other countries like Australia and New Zealand, they haven't had, they've closed their country. So they've been able to continue to compete and train as normal. And so I think that's kept everyone motivated, is to be at our highest level. And so I feel like everyone's done a really good job, and I'm really excited to see how everyone performs in a few weeks at the trials.
Kelsey Worldalia is an Olympic gold medal swimmer who is joining us ahead of the Tokyo Games and the U.S. trials, which begin next month. So, Kelsey, excuse me, the 100-meter butterfly has always been your specialty. Still is ahead of the trials?
It is. It is my favorite event going into the meet, and it'll be June 13th and 14th. So I have to swim three times and finish first or second in the final in order to make the team.
You competed, of course, again in the 2016 Games in Rio. So what has changed for you as you look ahead to the trials this time around ahead of, they're still being called the 2020 Games?
Mm-hmm. I come in this time as a veteran. Last time I went in as the underdog, and this time my biggest competitor is 10 years younger than me. So it definitely changes the scenario a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And so I have my work cut out for me. There's some really fast girls that have come up, and so I've got some work to do, and I'm excited to have a really good race.
So you will turn, if I'm right, 27, right as the games get underway or just before?
Right, that's correct.
And last time around in Rio, you would have been 22. You know, you are a young woman, Kelsey, but still, does 5 years make a big difference in body performance at the elite level?
It does. And through the last few years, my training has been adjusting to my body getting older, and not old in any way, but I'm not 22 or 21 anymore, so just the recovery side of things has become more of a priority, and knowing that my training won't look the same. So just still trusting in my coaches that their plan is what's best for me.
So let's get back to the Olympics again, coming up at the end of July. According to the IOC's John Coates, measures being taken to protect athletes and others will ensure that the Tokyo Olympics are safe regarding COVID. What are your thoughts as an athlete? What is your comfort level heading into a situation where there are going to be an awful lot of other people around?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been living in Kentucky, and we've had the vaccine rollout for quite a while. So I've been able to be fully vaccinated. And so I know that the USOC, just like in 2016 with the mosquitoes and the concerns with Zika going into Rio, they handled it very well, and I wasn't concerned. I knew that they had our best interests in heart. And so going into Tokyo, I've already seen the playbook that they have with all the COVID protocol, and I know it'll be really strict. So it's a balance, because the whole purpose is for us to compete, but we also need to prioritize health too. So I think that they're doing a really good job.
Are you at liberty? Are you at liberty to tell us about any of the protocol?
I don't have it memorized. It's a lot, but it will include a lot of testing and masks and social distancing, pretty similar to what's been set as a standard the last year and a half.
Okay. Well, you know, post-Tokyo Olympics, what do you think about the prospect of either continuing or moving on? Have you been swimming competitively since you were a child? What are your thoughts there?
Mm-hmm. I have been swimming for about 20 years now. And the last few years have been challenging. I do still love to compete and love to get to travel. I've committed to another season with the International Swim League. This will be the third season. And my team, the Cali Condors, was the champion last year. So that was a blast. After that, I'm going to take it one meet at a time and one season at a time, because I am married and excited to have a family. But my swimming career can only last for so long. So I want to make sure that I finish well and without any regrets.
So how might your Olympic experience help you to navigate the world in work and in family?
Being an Olympic swimmer has opened so many doors. It's allowed me to travel to teach other swimmers and get to share my story. I've been working a lot more on public speaking, and I'd love to continue to do that in the future. And it has given me so much in terms of the worldwide connections with friendships and relationships, as well as just time management, and giving me a perspective in that. So I'm not exactly sure what the next chapter holds, but I know that it will be exciting, and gotten into a little bit on the side real estate investing, and also serving at my church. So I feel like it will be a little bit of everything.
So again, you told us you've been swimming since I think you were, what, 6 years old. Did it, I think if I remember correctly, because you used to live near me, you began swimming mm-hmm. at a community pool. What would you say to those young kids who might be where you were 20 years ago and who have dreams of Olympic competition?
Mm-hmm. The beauty of swimming is, and the curse, I guess, is that it is a black and white sport. You can see your progress so clearly, but it's also so easy to get caught up in comparing yourself to other people, because someone's faster than can be seen as they're a little better. But everyone's journey is so different. When I was in high school, there was no chance I was going to make the Olympic team, but I got a lot better in college. So my encouragement is just to keep the process and set progress goals and season goals, and just enjoy the journey and focus on your specific path, because everyone's is so different.
All right, Kelsey Worldalia, U.S. Olympic gold medal swimmer in 2016 in Rio. Thanks again for joining us. Best of luck to you, and stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
All right, stay with us as the regional roundup continues.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. School wraps up in just a few short weeks for teens across the Delaware Valley. And for those looking for summer work, the job market is really promising. As the economy picks up steam, many businesses find themselves unable to fill empty positions. We're going to be discussing interview techniques, what to expect as you enter the workplace, and more. Also, research has shown it can be a lot tougher for young people living in low-income communities to find work. Challenges include poverty, the impact of crime on families, and a lack of access to jobs and networking. Still, our next guest says opportunities are out there, and it is part of her organization's mission to help teens and young adults connect with employers, jobs, and job training. Shakima Fulmore-Townsend is president and CEO of the nonprofit Philadelphia Youth Network, and she joins us now on the Regional Roundup. Welcome, Shakima.
Thank you, Debbie, for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So there are a lot of good-paying jobs out there right now for young people, and this includes within the city of Philadelphia. Give us a sense, Shakima, of what type of work is available.
Sure. So first, I want to give young people and parents listening, community members who care about young people, some very clear instructions about how you can gain access to those jobs. Mm-hmm. If you go to workready.org, it has one-stop shopping for every person who is interested. If you're a young person, it's an easy way to apply. If you're a business and you want to partner with us to host a young person this summer, you can sign up to do that as well. You can ask questions. And so I do want to make sure that every single person has access to our website, which is workready.org. There are a lot of different types of jobs this summer. And one of the most important things is safety. So we are focused on what it means to have safe in-person experiences for young people. Young people will be expected to participate in person about 3 days a week. So it will be a hybrid experience. Some of your work you will do in at an office or at your worksite location, and other parts of your job will happen similar to remote schooling happening in your home or wherever you feel safe and can complete the task. And so that will be something that is very new. In terms of the types of jobs that mm-hmm. we have with young people, it's a range. Some young people will be working in our local libraries and in our local day camps with the Department of Recreation. There are several lifeguard positions available this summer with the City of Philadelphia, but also some young people will work at nonprofits like my organization. We always host up to 5 to 10 interns in a summer, and you could be doing things like supporting our board or following up with our donors and learning about back office functions. And others will be in daily jobs within their community, helping to create new solutions and ensure that young people are engaged productively or solving community problems. And so we have a real range of experiences.
Yeah, there's a lot out there. So let me reintroduce you. Shakima Fulmore Townsend is president and CEO of the Philadelphia Youth Network. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. You are listening to the Regional Roundup. And so, Shakima, what do young people bring to the table when they first start with an organization? What are the attributes?
That's such a great question. The attributes that I have the pleasure of seeing, and we have provided since 1999, over 225,000 opportunities. So that's a lot of young people that we have had the fortune of getting to know. And I've been with the organization for 16 of our 22 years. So I've been there for quite some time. And what we see is both innovative thinking, a fresh perspective, and their curiosity and the questions. I think you can uncover what really makes sense in your organization and sometimes things that really don't make sense when you have to explain it to someone who's unfamiliar. You start to learn where some holes or gaps or assumptions might be. Young people are incredibly savvy marketers around social media usage. For us at our organization, they helped us rethink volunteers. They helped us rethink how we communicate to young people. They literally helped us redesign our website and our messaging. They gave us some great insight and feedback. And they helped us really hone in on what our voice would be in the social media space and which vehicles are best for us. And so those are some very tangible skills that they can bring to any business.
It can be difficult for young people who are living in high poverty areas to access opportunity. What are some of the reasons why?
Well, you know, I can speak from personal experience here, having been a young person before and grown up in poverty. And I see some of the same trajectory in the young people that we serve today. There are a couple of barriers. One of them is just lack of social capital or lack of relationships and connections within the workplace. And so when you don't have people who are willing to sponsor you or guide you or give you guidance about the process is just unfamiliar to you. How do I get a working papers? How do I go about preparing for an interview? For some, it might be even very basic, like how do I dress appropriately for an interview? And what do I do if I don't actually have what I need? Transportation to get to an interview or to and from a job. And those are the kinds of things that we help young people learn and acquire. And then sometimes it's just difficult because you may or may not have the prerequisites that you need. I want to get a job. I want to get my working papers, but I don't have access to my birth certificate that proves my age. And I don't have the money to get a duplicate one. I don't have my social security card because we've moved 3-4 times in the last 3-4 years. And those papers have become transient or, you know, lost. And we don't have the funds to recover it, or we can't sacrifice our basic needs to do this, which seems like a necessity, but a luxury in relation to, do I have enough money for breakfast tomorrow? Mm. You know?
So, and can you, an organization such as yours, help these young people access these important items so that they can get started?
Absolutely. We teach them about the process. We teach that, we provide resources to help them if they do experience those barriers. And we also follow up with them. And I think that's another barrier that's sort of underestimated. When you have many challenges, the one that's the loudest gets your attention the fastest. And so, you know, getting a job or being employed as a teenager may feel like a luxury when you are maybe housing in like a luxury, when you are maybe housing insecure, or you are, you know, currently couch surfing or moving from family member to family member. Those logistics become a lot more important than I have to make it to a place to get the, you know, get my birth certificate or things of that nature. And so we do try to support young people at different stages so that they can achieve their goals.
So what would you say to coach a young person facing these obstacles in order to get around, past the obstacles, so that they can somehow fit work into their lives?
Well, a plan. You're going to have to become really good at accepting help. And there is no shame in accepting help. And there's no blame in the circumstances that you're in. And so I think that sometimes the stigma and the fear of what's going to happen if you are honest about your needs is something that young people face. So I try to coach them on that. I would also encourage them to be mindful that this is your circumstances today. What we're trying to help you do is prepare for your successful future. And in order to change that, you have to start now. And so how do we balance the real constraints with the future that you want to have?
So let's say the young person has landed a job interview. First impression, really important. Tips, tricks, and suggestions for presenting yourself as best as possible.
Absolutely. So you never get a second chance to make a first impression, but you can improve upon people's initial thoughts about you. So I would say young people tend to be very engaged with their devices. I would want to say to them, once you enter the workplace, put your device away. Take your headsets out. Not because there's something wrong with that. It's because there's a generational gap. And oftentimes people interpret that as being disinterested, rude. And they think they make up assumptions. You could be listening to the latest podcast on the industry, and you could be becoming very informed about what is current. And that could be a huge asset, but that's not the impression that that gives. And so we do work with adults to address bias and address, confront some assumptions that people make about young people that just are not true, but they're just different. They're wired differently. Socially, they're different. And I think adults have to also work at making space for them. The second piece is dress the part and dress for your industry. Does not necessarily mean you have to be dressed up. What I would wear to a bank interview, which tends to be a more conservative environment, would not be what I would wear to an interview if I had an internship at a fashion magazine.
Yeah.
Right? Where they want to see your curiosity. And oftentimes you will hear adults talk about just comb your hair and pick up your pants and, like, you know, this sort of respectability politics conversation. And that's not the right advice for young people. The right advice is to observe the trends of your industry and then dress for the job you want, not the job you have. And part of that is knowing what's acceptable in that industry and showing up accordingly. So I would give that. And the other piece is know your assets. It's an exchange. They exchange in a working relationship. The exchange is often money for your time and your talent.
Yeah.
Your time and your talent is valuable. You have to be articulate about what those talents are and confident in how you express them without being cocky. So there's a level of assertion that you should show up with, that you believe in your skills and that they are worth investing in.
Yeah, there's a balance there. And for a young person who's just walking into their first interview, I imagine it can be intimidating to sit before an adult, whether live or on Zoom, and communicate effectively and with confidence. Does the conversation have to be perfect?
It doesn't have to be perfect. And that's why we work with both young people and the adults that they're interviewing, right? That's why we set the adults up for success as well by helping them with rubrics and thinking outside of the box about what you're assessing, what you see, and what could potentially be there. What were some of the redeemable qualities? Did you feel like the young person was coachable? Because they are young people, right? They're learning. So how much tolerance do you have for learning? Did you feel an authentic connection? Did you see any budding skills that your particular expertise could be helpful in blossoming with that young person? So it's a little bit of a different criteria when you're interviewing young people. It's not just what you see, but what you could possibly create with them if you gave them a chance.
So, and say the job interview doesn't work out, as so many of us face rejection sometimes, you know, when we go for something, employment that we'd like to have. How do you coach a kid through that?
Everybody has to learn from failure. We all have to learn from failure. And that's such a critical skill in the lifelong learning. And so what we help young people to understand two things. One, what is for you will not pass you by. So that was not the opportunity for you. Two, how can you improve and do better? Did you do your best? If they say yes, we can share the feedback that the adult observed or ways in which they can improve. And then we prepare you to do it again, because every opportunity to succeed has met, you've had to do it multiple times. There's very few people who are just excellent first try every single time they try something. And so this is the opportunity for you to show resilience, to show your fortitude, to show your ability to get knocked down, but also get back up. And we teach young people to do that.
What do young people need to bear in mind about their responsibilities and their rights, especially entering the workplace in this kind of shifting time of COVID? We're not really quite sure how it's going to pan out here in the next few months.
Well, not only are we not quite sure, it changes, and it changes pretty rapidly. Just on Friday, new regulations were released related to business operations. And I could imagine if the data trend reverses, we'll get more regulations, right? And I'm hopeful that they will continue, that we will continue to vaccination rates go up, COVID incidents go down, you know, that our bodies are adjusting to this so that we won't be, it's such, not such a chaotic event. But young people need to know, one, once you become an employee, you're entitled to the same rights as every other employee. If you're in an industry where PPE is required, you are entitled to those masks and gloves, all of the things that are needed to do the job. You too are entitled to it. You're not a special employee. You're a youth employee. You're still an employee. And that's an important point. And then the other thing that young people need to know is that there are youth employment rules designed to protect them. It's such things like you have to have a work permit, because when you, the work permit is a form of an agreement between the employer and the young person related to hours worked, rate of pay, those kinds of things. So there are ways in which the system works to protect young people. The other piece I would say is asking questions about the norms of the business so that you understand when you should have to turn in your timesheet. What should you do if you cannot make it to work? What's acceptable communication? What are alternatives? All of those things are real situations that we all face as employees. The difference is that you might have had an orientation and you may have had jobs before, and so you have a pretty good sense of what's expected and what's acceptable. For some young people, this is their first job, or it's their first job in that industry, and so they will not have the unspoken rules that we all live by. You will have to teach them some of that.
Yeah. Philadelphia School District, for one, will be offering summer learning. Many young people will be attending class to try to make up for ground loss during the pandemic, and they might be working as well. What are the challenges here? How might you advise them?
You know, young people are really resilient, and the challenge is maybe just balancing your schedule and communicating your priorities or asking for what you need to be successful. And so I think negotiation will be critical. And I think also businesses have become much more open to being flexible as we navigated Zoom and all that came with going into people's homes during the workday, right? And so there may be a dog or a cat that comes into the screen, or a baby, or a husband in my case, who makes lunch in the background while I'm on meetings if I was working in my kitchen. And so I think the negotiation piece and just being upfront and candid about your limitations, what we have found is that employers are very receptive. You just have to communicate it. And I think making sure that every young person knows that it's okay to communicate it rather than trying to resolve the challenges, because we all want you to be successful educationally. And then employment reinforces what you're learning in the classroom. And so we want, it's a win-win for young people to be able to do both. And it's just about navigating what schedule and where you need to be, and communicating that and building your work schedule around that.
So Shakima Fulmore Townsend, what is the single most important piece of advice you would pass along to a teen or young adult just starting out in the workforce who might be listening to this interview?
Ooh, most important. There's so many things. I would say my first would be nothing beats a failure but a try. So if you do not apply, you are not in the game. So you have to apply, which means you're going to have to go fill out an application at your local, whatever, Readers, Rite Aid, whatever. In retail is definitely hiring a lot of folks. Everywhere I go and throughout my community, I see hiring, dollar store hiring. And they may not be the job that you want for your life. It's not intended to be that. It's intended to be a job to acclimate you to work. And so I think sometimes we get that confused. It's not in my industry. It's not what I want. But it can teach you something. And if it can help you earn money and learn how to be more responsible, more committed, give you some leadership opportunity, it may be worth exploring. You don't have to stay in that job. You can start and then progress. And I think sometimes young people don't know that you can progress from a job.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. But workready.org is the place to head to, right? For more information. Shakima Fulmore Townsend, thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Debbie.
Shakima Fulmore Townsend is president and CEO of Philadelphia Youth Network. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This is the Regional Roundup. We'll be talking about allergy season straight ahead. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. I finally had my car washed the other day, and an hour later started to regret it. A fine dusting of yellow was already settling on the finish, indicative of what allergy sufferers know all too well, that we are not out of the woods yet when it comes to pollen. In fact, it's prime season right now for some tree pollens. So how is 2021 measuring up when it comes to pollen seasons of the past? What are some common symptoms of allergic reactions to pollen? How do we best tackle or prevent them? And does wearing a mask help? Our guest for the rest of the hour spends a chunk of his day capturing, counting, and identifying grains of pollen. Dr. Donald Dvorin is the only certified pollen counter for the Philadelphia region. He's a member of the Asthma and Allergy Doctors Practice with offices in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And he is here for the rest of the hour. Lines are open. If you've got any questions, 888-477-9499. Send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Donald Dvorin, hello.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So give us a sense of what's happening right now. Are we starting to move away from pine and other tree pollens and maybe toward grasses?
We're starting that, but pine is actually peaking in this area. So those coated windows that you referred to are mostly pine at this point. We're beyond the oak tree pollen at this point, but we're still seeing other, you know, trees such as birch trees, for example.
So does pine tree pollen largely impact areas near the pinelands in New Jersey, or are we seeing it, that yellow film across pretty much the Delaware Valley?
pretty much across the Delaware Valley. Pine trees are planted everywhere in the Delaware Valley. We just happen to, in southern New Jersey, be right next to the forest. But it's known that pollen grains can travel as much as 10 to 20 miles or even longer if they're smaller. Pine happens to be a heavy pollen, and that's why you see it on your windows.
Well, pollen particles are tiny for the most part. What, remind us of what their role is in nature, Donald.
They have the role of reproduction, basically, for the tree. One of the multiple ways of reproduction, but it's the most abundant form of reproduction for the tree. So one tree can produce 10 million or more pollen grains per season. And it's incredible how much they have to put out just to survive.
10 million. Wow.
At least 10 million. Yeah.
So they're really important, these tiny little pollen particles. But of course, they also have the power to make an awful lot of people miserable. Tell us about some of the symptoms you are seeing at the office.
Yes, everybody is sensitized this time of year. It seems like even people without allergies, for example, are irritated by the high concentration. But what we see at the office are people with sneezing, itchy, watery eyes, nasal congestion, or nasal blockage, and even allergic asthma gets worse this time of year when it's so high. And people really notice it all the way through the season, which we're expecting to go through June at this point.
Through June, wow. So, and we should probably distinguish allergy symptoms from COVID? I mean, are there some that overlap, and how might we just be able to, you know, tell the difference?
The main difference, good question, is lack of sense of smell. You do not get that with an allergic symptom unless it's extreme. But the sense of smell has been reported up to 96% in COVID.
Yeah.
And it's probably less than 10% in allergy. So that would be a big factor in distinguishing it. Another one is your exposure environment. If you're indoors and you're not feeling your allergies, you just walk out and then start getting it.
Yeah.
You have your answer. It's got to be your allergic symptoms.
And do folks who have allergies normally get a fever or at times get feverish? Because that's another COVID symptom.
No, they will not get feverish. They will not have any of the other symptoms that you've seen with COVID, such as a bad cough, unless your asthma acts up, of course.
Yeah.
They will not have any of the serious joint pain, abdominal pain, severe weakness you will not see in an allergic patient. But you can see mild weakness with people who are allergy sufferers.
Okay, so you know, most of us, of course, are wearing masks these days to avoid, you know, catching coronavirus. Does wearing a mask also help to lessen the severity of allergies?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you can filter the air going through your nose and mouth, you certainly can reduce your exposure level. Unfortunately, though, masks are open on the sides, so there is a degree of pollen that can penetrate when you're exposed outdoors. However, now that people are not wearing masks outdoors with the new guidelines, it may actually increase your allergy symptoms.
Okay. We've got calls and comments coming in already. We've got an email from Brian who says, I feel like my allergies are the worst they've ever been by far, and I'm wondering if it's because of little exposure to anything this year since we've been masked and socially distanced, or could the vaccine have made my immune system extra sensitive to any perceived invaders? Any truth to this?
No, the vaccine has not been shown to enhance any allergic symptoms whatsoever, so that shouldn't be a factor. What is a factor is the weather and the environment that's different this year. We've had actually periods of higher temperatures and wind, and that raises the pollen counts dramatically. We've also seen earlier levels of pollen than usual, and we're actually experiencing a longer season overall for pollen. So people can be sensitized to their pollen at an early stage in the season, but then later become more intensely sick with their pollen allergies.
Donald DeVoren is an allergist with the Allergy and Asthma Doctor's Offices in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. He is also the only certified pollen counter for the Philadelphia region. So, Donald, are pollen seasons becoming more intense because of climate change?
Yes, yes, there's definitely been documented studies with ragweed extending the season. And we've actually seen in our pollen collection site a grass pollen season that occurs in September, which has not been well reported. And we've seen that for the last 5 years at least happening more and more. So we see off-season pollen levels, which we normally would not expect.
So, and if this trend continues, it's just tough news for allergy sufferers down the road.
Absolutely. If we continue to be warm, the plants reproduce. The plant produces more pollen and can regrow. High CO2 levels can also promote growth of weeds or trees. So this is happening on a daily basis.
Flowers are also producing pollen right now. Are they contributing to the symptoms that allergy sufferers are experiencing?
Usually not. Flowers have heavy, sticky pollen. So that's why bees are primary in transferring their pollen to other plants and fertilizing them. So usually they're so heavy, they do not go in the air. But I do see an occasional flower pollen in the air, even two stories up from where our pollen machine is located.
Well, let's talk about the work you do as a certified pollen counter. You produce a daily update. How does the process of counting pollen work?
It's very labor intensive, unfortunately. We use a device known as the Burkhard Spore Trap, which was developed in England years ago and updated since then. So we place a slide into the machine, which passes a layer of air, suctioning through it, layering onto the slide over a 24-hour period. And I collect that every morning. Usually try to get up there around 7:30 in the morning. Then I place the slide under a microscope with a special stain called Calberilla stain. That stain penetrates the pollen particles so you can see the different ornaments and different qualities of the pollen to identify it. So we have to be specific about the species of the pollen we collect, and we have to report it together, which is reported to the National Allergy Bureau. The National Allergy Bureau is a division of the American Academy of Allergy. And that's actually reported on a daily basis for about 80 pollen stations throughout the U.S.
There are only 80 pollen stations in the U.S.?
There's only 80 certified pollen stations. There are other organizations that do pollen forecasting, but that is not accepted by the American Academy of Allergy or the National Allergy Bureau. It's very difficult to forecast on a daily basis because weather changes locally, and that will change dramatically what your levels are.
So one more question before we move on. So by eye, you are looking at these pollen grains and you are counting them every morning?
Absolutely. You have to do it under the 40X ocular for pollen. And we have to do a sweep through the whole slide, which can take up to an hour this time of the year when we're at our peak.
And have you ever seen a type of pollen that you really didn't expect to see in the slide?
Absolutely. I have seen unusual pollen. For example, last week I saw peach pollen. So the peach trees are starting to come out, and you wouldn't expect it. It's a flowering tree. But you do see that. And, of course, unknowns. There are pollen which can come from distances, from unknown trees, which we have difficulty identifying. So you always have one or two unknowns in the slide, on a daily basis.
It's important work, and it sounds like it can be really fascinating, but also hard on the eyes. Do you enjoy it?
Yes, absolutely. I've been doing it since the 90s. By the way, you have to become certified for this, meaning you have to take tests and you have to pass the tests to actually be able to report it officially to the network. So it's difficult, but it's very rewarding, especially for our patients. We send the emails directly to our patients who actually get the levels on a daily basis and actually notice when their pollen induced allergies are worse.
Indeed, important work. So back to some specifics now, Donald Doran. Grass pollens, I guess they will intensify soon, correct?
Grass is definitely in the air in a moderate level at this point.
Okay.
Moderate.
So
we usually peak in early June, the first week of June for grass.
How does mowing affect this, if at all?
Mowing increases the grass pollen release. So if you're not protected with a good mask and goggles and you're an allergic sufferer, you're in trouble. You may have to really be very careful about your exposure level, which can produce asthma, can produce nasal obstruction, sinus pain and headaches, all of that.
Yeah. So, and does keeping grass long or short make a difference?
Keeping grass short does make a difference. The shorter it is, the longer it takes for pollination to rejuvenate itself. So yes, keeping grass short is a good recommendation.
Is there a difference in the way seasonal allergies tend to affect people in urban versus suburban or rural areas?
Yes, there are differences. There's obviously less vegetation, but there are street trees everywhere in the urban environment, which definitely produce a significant level, but there are fewer plants. However, in my studies, we had a Philadelphia station, which I was involved with, and the station showed a slightly decreased pollen count, but a higher mold spore count compared to our New Jersey site. So there are some differences, but not that dramatic, believe it or not.
Okay.
It has to do with the length of distance, you know, that the pollen is traveling.
Does pollution play a part when it comes to folks who might be living in an urban area who are experiencing some allergy systems? Does pollution exacerbate those symptoms?
Absolutely. Pollution can exacerbate it. The pollen particles can actually attach to pollution particles and then travel farther, it's known. But on my slides, interestingly enough, I do see a lot of unidentified particles, which are probably pollutants in that regard. So we know that they're hand in hand.
All right. Aziz has sent us an email and says, even with taking allergy medicines and wearing a face mask, I still get sneeze attacks, itchy eyes, and headaches. I only started to suffer from about 6 years ago when I moved to the suburbs of Philly from central PA. Will I, at a certain point, heal or not suffer from pollen allergy, or do I have to live with this the rest of my life?
Unfortunately, you are going to live with it if you don't get better care. If you go to a specialist in this area, an allergist, there are so many different improved treatments such as allergy injections, which will really help the symptoms dramatically. Otherwise, you're going to continue to have your symptoms on a seasonal basis like you're describing.
So find a good doctor if you are suffering and
absolutely
from there. Let's talk a little bit about prevention. Can there be too much of a good thing when it comes to hygiene? I've heard it can actually be beneficial to say, if you have children, let them get good and dirty while playing outside. Can this help prevent allergies?
Yes, you're absolutely right. The hygiene hypothesis has been around for about 25 years, and it's been proven that the more exposure to varieties of outdoor pollutants or dirt, et cetera, as well as multiple animals, that you will have less allergic sensitization. So it's your immune system getting stronger to resistance of those other particles, even bacteria, that allow you not to develop the allergic cascade.
Okay. Do you experience allergies yourself?
I have indoor allergies, but at times like this where our pine pollen is high, you definitely notice it. Even if you're a non-allergic sufferer or an allergic sufferer, you still have multiple symptoms that go with it.
Yeah. So how much longer, Donald DeVoren, are we in spring pollen season, and what comes after that?
Okay, we're toward the end of spring pollen season. As I said, we'll probably experience tree pollen until June, but grass pollen will hang on till July. And then in August, ragweed and weed pollen is produced. So they take over for the allergic allergy sufferer. Yes.
So get ready, right?
Absolutely.
Donald DeVoren, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mary.
Donald DeVoren is an allergist with the Allergy and Asthma Doctors Group in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and is also the Philadelphia region's only certified pollen counter. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us. Be well.